swathed in clothes, their faces painted with gold. They are placed in mausoleums of massive silver, studded with precious stones. A pane of glass is sometimes fitted in these cases, on a level with the head, so that the gilded face can be seen. Other grand lamas are incinerated with butter and their bones preserved in rich caskets. All funeral monuments, in Tibet, take the form of khotan, which are imitations of the stupas which the ancient Buddhists of India built over their holy dead, or other precious relics. In obedience to Buddhist beliefs in the excellence of charitable deeds, lamaists find, in the funerals, a fitting occasion for a supreme act of charity. The dead man wished, or is supposed to have wished, that his body should serve as his last gift, to nourish those tormented by hunger. A work entitled, A Guide for the Spirit of the Dead in the Next World, expounds the subject as follows. 1. The body is transported to the top of a mountain. It is dismembered, the four limbs being cut off with a well-sharpened knife. The entrails, the heart, the lungs are laid out on the ground. The birds, wolves and foxes feed themselves upon them. 2. The body is thrown into a sacred river. The blood and the humors are dissolved in the blue water. The fish and the otters eat the flesh and the fat. 3. The body is burned. Flesh, bones and skin are reduced to a heap of cinders. The teasers are nourished by the odor. 4. The body is hidden in the earth. Flesh, bones and skin are sucked by worms. Families who can afford to pay the officiating monks have the religious service repeated every day, for 6 weeks following the funerals. After this, an effigy is made with a light frame of sticks, supporting clothes that belonged to the deceased. A sheet of paper represents the face. The portrait of the dead person is sometimes sketched upon it. More often a printed paper sheet is bought, ready-made, in a monastery. There are two models, one being the picture of a man, the other that of a woman. The name of the departed is written under the drawn portrait or the printed picture. There is one more, final, religious ceremony, at the close of which the officiating lama burns the paper sheet, or face of the dead person. The clothes in which the effigy was dressed are given to the lama as part of his fee. After this symbolic incineration, the ties which might still have attached the deceased to this world are considered to be definitely severed. Tibetans keenly desire avoiding any intercourse with the dead. Peasants use especially precise words to get rid of them. Just before the corpse is carried out of the house, a meal is served to him and an aged member of the family harangues him, in these words, "So and so, listen. You are dead, be sure of that. You have nothing more to do here. Eat copiously for the last time. You have a long road to run and several mountain passes to cross. Take strength and do not return again." I heard an even stranger discourse. After having duly told the dead man that he no longer belonged to this world and bidding him never to reappear, the orator added, "Pagzin, I must tell you that your house has been destroyed by fire, everything you possessed is burned. Because of a debt you had forgotten, your creditor has taken your two sons away as slaves. Your wife has left with a new husband. As it would sadden you to see all this misery, be careful not to return." I listened in astonishment to this extraordinary list of calamities. "How did this series of misfortunes happen?" I asked an assistant. "Nothing at all has happened," he answered, smiling maliciously. "The farm and the cattle are intact and the widow is sitting quietly at home with the sons. We invented that tale to disgust Pagzin so that he will not think of returning to his home." This seemed rather a naive stratagem for people who credit the spirit with the faculty of seeing what is going on in our world. In liturgical terms far more solemn than those employed by the villagers, the lama also advises the departed one to follow his road without looking backward. But this counsel is for his own good, while the common people only think of avoiding the occult presence of a ghost which they consider dangerous. During the celebration of these various ceremonies, the spirit travels through the bardo. He beholds, in turn, radiant beautiful beings and hideous forms. He sees diversely colored paths and a crowd of strange visions. These apparitions frighten him, He is bewildered and wanders at random among them. If he is able to hear and to follow the advices of the officiating Lama, he can take a road that will lead him to be reborn among the gods, or in some other pleasant condition just as the initiate may, who has entered consciously into the Bardo after a careful study of its map. But men who have not learned anything about the Bardo, and who enter it while absorbed in their regret at leaving the material world, can hardly profit by the counsels given to them. So they miss the opportunity of escaping the mathematically rigid consequences of their actions. The roads to celestial happiness are behind them. The wombs of human and of animal beings are offered them and, deceived by their hallucinations, they fancy these to be pleasant grottos or palaces. Thinking they will find an agreeable resting place, they enter one or another of them and thus determine for themselves the conditions of their rebirth. This one will become a dog, while another will be the son of distinguished human parents. According to other beliefs, the great mass of people who have not obtained post-mortem spiritual illumination, by seizing the meaning of the vision which arose before them immediately after death, travel like a frightened flock of sheep through the phantasmagoria of Bardo, until they reach the court of Shinji, the judge of the dead. Shinji examines their past actions in a mirror or weighs them under the form of white and black pebbles. According to the predominance of good or of evil deeds, he determines the species of beings among whom the spirit will be reborn and the particular conditions that shall accompany this rebirth, such as physical beauty or ugliness, intellectual gifts, social standing of the parents, etc. There is no question of skillfulness in saving oneself here, for the judge is impartial and inflexible. In fact, even at the time when skillfulness may be helpful, it only acts within the limit permitted by the power of past actions. I have already mentioned this limitation and will, now, give an amusing illustration of it which is characteristic of Tibetan humor. A Grand Lama had passed his whole life in idleness. Although he had been given excellent tutors in his youth, had inherited from his predecessors an important library and had, moreover, always been surrounded by men of learning, still, he scarcely knew how to read. This Lama died. In these times there lived a strange man, a miracle worker and rough-speaking philosopher, whose eccentricities, sometimes coarse, often exaggerated by his biographers, have given birth to a number of stories in the style of Ray Bliss, much appreciated in Tibet. Dugpa Kunlegs, for such was his name, travelled under the guise of a vagabond. Having arrived at the bank of a brook, he saw a girl who had come there to draw water. Suddenly he attacked her, and without saying a word he tried to violate her. The lass was robust and Dugpa Kunlegs was approaching old age. She defended herself so vigorously that she escaped him, and, running back to the village, told her mother what had happened. The good woman was most astonished. The men of the country were well behaved, none of them could be suspected. The brute must be a stranger. She made her daughter minutely describe the wicked wretch. While listening to the girl, the mother wondered. The description of the man corresponded, in all points, to that of Dugpa Kunlegs, this eccentric and saintly lama whom she had met during a pilgrimage. There was no doubt possible. Dugpa Kunlegs, himself, had wished to abuse her daughter. She began to reflect on the strange behavior of the Holy One. The common moral principles which rule the conduct of ordinary men do not apply to men of supernormal wisdom, she thought. A sage and wonder worker. 27 is not bound to follow any law. His actions are dictated by superior considerations which escape the vulgar observer. So she said to her daughter, the man you have seen is the great Dugpa Kunlegs. Whatever he does is well done. Therefore, return to the brook, prostrate yourself at his feet and consent to anything he wishes. The girl went back and found the Dautob seated upon a stone, absorbed in his thoughts. She bowed down before him, excused herself for having resisted him when she had not known who he was, and declared that she was entirely at his service. The saint shrugged his shoulders. My child, he said, women awake no desire in me. However, the Grand Lama of the neighboring monastery has died in ignorance, having neglected all occasions of instruction. I saw his spirit wandering in the Budo, drawn towards a bad rebirth, and, out of compassion, I wished to procure him a human body, but the power of his evil deeds has not permitted this. You escaped, and while you were at the village, the asses in that field nearby, coupled. The Grand Lama will soon be reborn as a donkey. The majority of the dead men heed the desire of their families, as expressed during the funeral, and do not return. The latter conclude that their fate, in the next world, has been definitely settled and, probably, to their satisfaction. However, some departed ones are less discreet. They frequently appear in dreams to their relatives or their friends, and strange things happen in their former dwellings. Tibetans believe that this shows the spirit to be unhappy and calling for help. There are Lama diviners who can be consulted in such cases. Therefore, the rites to be celebrated, the gifts to be bestowed upon the clergy, and holy books to be read, to comfort the unhappy spirit. Nevertheless, many people, especially in those remote regions near the frontiers, fall back on the practices of the ancient Bons. They think that the dead man, himself, should be listened to. So a medium, male or female, is summoned to lend his voice to the departed one. Spiritualistic seances in Tibet do not resemble those of the Western countries. Neither darkness nor silence are required. Sometimes they are held in the open air. The Powo begins chanting, accompanying himself with a little drum and a bell. He dances, first slowly, then faster and faster, and, finally, trembles convulsively. A being of another world, god, demon or spirit of a dead person, has taken possession of him. In a kind of frenzy, he utters broken sentences, which are supposed to convey that which the invisible being wishes to communicate to the assistants. Since it is of the first importance to know exactly who is speaking through the medium, and what he is saying, the most intelligent men of the village are called upon to listen attentively. It sometimes happens that different gods or spirits take possession of the medium one after another. Once in a while, the latter, under the impulsion given to him by one of these beings, will suddenly attack one of the public and beat him mercilessly. This correction is always accepted without any resistance being offered. Tibetans imagine that it is meant to drive out a demon that has lodged himself in the man without his being aware of it. This undesirable guest has, however, been discovered by the spirit animating the medium. The departed ones who suffer in the next world usually limit their performances to giving an account of their misfortunes. At a seance, where I was a spectator, I heard one say, "I met a demon upon my road who dragged me into his dwelling. He made a slave of me. He forces me to work hard, without stopping, and ill-treats me. Have pity on me. Set me free so that I may reach the paradise of the great bliss." The mother of the man who was supposed to be speaking, as well as his wife and children, wept bitter tears. Families who receive supplications of this kind think of nothing but how to liberate the unfortunate captive. It is a complicated affair. First, one must get into communication with the demon and negotiate the ransom of his prisoner. The chosen intermediary is often a Bon sorcerer. He informs the relatives of the unhappy spirit that his demoniacal master demands the sacrifice of a pig or a cow, before setting him free. Having offered the victim, the Bon enters into a trance. His double is supposed to visit the dwelling place of the demon. He travels. The way is long and hard, full of obstacles. This, the sorcerer indicates by his contortions. But unlike the Powo, he remains seated, moving only his head and his bust. A flow of hurried words are uttered telling the various incidents of his adventure. He is even more difficult to understand than the Powo. The cleverest listeners find it hard to make out the sense of his words. The Bon has accomplished his task. Now he has seized the spirit and prepares to take him away. The demon has received the ransom demanded, but he usually breaks faith and tries to hold on to his slave. The sorcerer fights him. One can see him struggling and panting, one can hear his screams. The family and friends of the dead men follow the phases of the drama with the greatest anxiety. They are overjoyed when the sorcerer declares that he has been successful, and has led the spirit to an agreeable place. but the first attempt does not always succeed. I have witnessed several performances where the sorcerer, after having simulated extraordinary efforts, declared that the spirit had been taken away from him by the demon. In this case, all rites, sacrifices, and the payment of the bonds fees, must begin all over again. When a lama is called upon to save a spirit from slavery, no sacrifice is performed for redemption and the rites that are celebrated ignore all negotiation. The lama, who is learned in the magic ritual, considers himself powerful enough to compel the demon to release his victim. Under the influence of Buddhism, the inhabitants of Tibet proper have given up sacrificing animals. This is far from being true of Tibetans living in the Himalayas who have only a thin coating of lamaism and have remained practically shamanists. The beliefs of the learned lamas and of contemplative mystics differ greatly from those held by the masses about the fate of the spirit in the next world. To begin with, they consider all the incidents of the journey in the Budo as purely subjective visions. The nature of these visions depends on the ideas the man has held when he was living. The various paradises, the hells and the judge of the dead appear to those who have believed in them. A Gomchen of Eastern Tibet told me the following story upon this subject. A painter whose principal work was that of decorating temples, often painted the fantastic beings with human bodies and animal heads, who are supposed to be the attendants of Shinge. His son, who was still a very young child, often stayed beside him while he worked and amused himself looking at the monstrous forms appearing in the frescoes. Now it happened that the boy died, and entering the Budo, met the terrible beings whose images were familiar to him. Far from being frightened, he began to laugh. "Oh, I know you all," he said. "My father makes you on the walls, and he wished to play with them." I once asked the Lama of Inch what would be the post-mortem subjective visions of a materialist who had looked upon death as total annihilation. "Perhaps," said the Lama, "such man would see apparitions corresponding to the religious beliefs he held in his childhood, or to those, familiar to him, held by the people among whom he has lived. According to the degree of his intelligence and his post-mortem lucidity, he would, perhaps, examine and analyze these visions and remember the reasons which, during his lifetime, made him deny the reality of that which now appears to him. He might, thus, conclude that he is beholding a mirage." A less intelligent man in whom belief in total annihilation was the result of indifference or dullness, rather than of reasoning, will, perhaps, see no vision at all. However, this will not prevent the energy generated by his past actions from following its course and manifesting itself through new phenomena. In other words, it will not prevent the rebirth of the materialist. My many copied books filled with notes showed that I had worked a great deal since I had come to Sikkim. I thought I might allow myself a holiday. Summer was approaching, the warmer temperature tempted me to undertake a trip in the north of the country. The road I chose was an excellent mule track leading from Gangtok to Kampadzong and on to Shigatse in Tibet. Rising gradually from the traveler's bungalow of Dikchu buried in the tropical jungle, on the bank of the Tista, it follows a tributary of this river up to its source, passing through enchanting landscapes. At about 50 miles from Gangtok, and at a height of 8,000 feet, this road crosses a village called Lakhan, which occupies a prominent place in my experiences of Lamaist mysticism. This little group of cottages is the most northern in Sikkim, the last which the traveler meets on his way towards the high passes of the Tibetan border. It is inhabited by sturdy hillmen, who combine a little farming, in the valley, with the rearing of yak, the hairy Tibetan ox. Yaks higher up on the Tibetan tableland, where they spend a part of the year under tents. Perched on a mountain slope, a humble monastery dominates the villagers' dwellings. I visited it the day after my arrival, but finding nothing of interest in the temple, I was about to leave when a shadow darkened the luminous space of the wide open door. A lama stood on the threshold. I say a lama, but the man did not wear the regular monastic garb, neither was he dressed as a layman. His costume consisted of a white skirt down to his feet, a garnet-colored waistcoat, Chinese in shape, and through the wide armholes, the voluminous sleeves of a yellow shirt were seen. A rosary made of some grey substance and coral beads hung around his neck. His pierced ears were adorned with large gold rings studded with turquoises, and his long, thick, braided hair touched his heels. Later on, I learned that this is the costume of the anchorites who are proficient in Tummo and various other branches of the secret lore. The rosary is made of 108 small round pieces of bone, each one cut out from a different human skull. This strange person looked at me without speaking, and as at that time I knew but little of the Tibetan language, I did not dare to begin a conversation. I only saluted him and went out. A young man, my general factotum, was waiting for me on the terrace of the monastery. As soon as he saw the Lama descending the steps of the peristyle, behind me, he prostrated himself thrice at his feet, asking for his blessing. This astonished me, for the lad was not usually lavish with such signs of respect, and honored none, in this way, but the Prince Tulku and Bermek Kushog. "Who is this Lama?" I asked him as I returned to the traveler's bungalow. "He is a great Gomchen," the boy replied. "One of his monks told me, while you were in the temple. He has spent years alone, in a cave high up in the mountains. Demons obey him and he works miracles. They say he can kill men at a distance and fly through the air. What an extraordinary man," I thought. My curiosity had been greatly excited by the stories regarding Tibetan Gomchens I had read with Dawa Sendup. I had also heard a great deal from the Prince Tulku and from various lamas, about the way of living of the Tibetan hermits, the curious doctrines they profess and the wonders they can perform. Now I had, most unexpectedly, come across one of them. This was a lucky opportunity. But how could I talk with the Lama? My boy was utterly ignorant of Tibetan philosophical terms. He would never be able to translate my questions. I was annoyed and excited. I slept badly, troubled by incoherent dreams. I saw myself surrounded by elephants who pointed at me musical trunks from which came out deep sounds like those of long Teban trumpets. This strange concert woke me. My room was plunged in darkness. I no longer saw the elephants, but I continued to hear the music. After listening attentively, I recognized religious tunes. The trippers were playing on the terrace of the temple. Who were they serenading in the night? Whatever might come of it, I wished to risk an interview with the Gomchen. I sent a request that he would see me, and the next day, accompanied by my boy, I returned to the monastery. A primitive staircase led to the Lama's apartment situated above the assembly hall. In front of the entrance door was a small loggia decorated with frescoes. While waiting to be invited in, I examined these with some amusement. On the walls, an artist, endowed with more imagination than professional skill, had represented the torments of the purgatories, peopling the latter with a host of demons and victims who grinned and writhed in the most comical attitudes. In the middle of a panel, lust was undergoing punishment. A naked man, abnormally thin, faced an unclothed woman. Her huge, disproportionate belly gave to this bell the appearance of an Easter egg mounted on 2 feet and topped with a doll head. The lecherous sinner, incorrigible slave of his passions, forgetting where he was and how he had been led there, hugged the infernal creature in his arms, while flames springing out from her mouth and from a secret recess scorched him. At a small distance from this couple, a sinful woman suffered her chastisement. Bound, in a reversed posture, to a triangle pointing downward, she was compelled to accept the caresses inflicted upon her by a green devil with teeth like a saw and a monkey's tail. In the background, other demons, variously colored, were seen running forward to take their turn. The Gomchen lived in a kind of dark chapel, lighted only at one end by a small window, the ceiling supported by wooden pillars painted red. According to the Tibetan custom, the altar served as bookcase. In a niche, among the books, stood a small image of Padmasambhava, with ritual offerings placed before it, 7 bowls filled with pure water, grain and a lamp. Incense sticks burning on a small table mingled their mystic fragrance with odors of tea and melted butter. The cushions and rugs piled up for the master to sit upon were threadbare and faded, and the tiny gold star of the altar lamp shining at the back of the room showed up its dust and emptiness. Through my boy acting as interpreter, I tried to ask several questions on subjects I had discussed with the lamas I had met at Gangtok, but it was useless. If only Dawes and Up had been with me. The young man was dumbfounded and unable to find words to express ideas whose meaning he could not grasp. I gave it up, and for a long time the lama and I sat facing each other in silence. The next day I left Lakhn, continuing my journey towards the north. Here the scenery, which all along the track lower down had been charming, became simply marvelous. The azalea and rhododendron thickets were still decked with their bright spring garment. A shimmering torrent of blossoms submerged the valley and seemed to be pouring out, on the neighboring slopes, a resistless flood of purple, yellow, red and pure white waves. Seen from a distance, my porters, whose heads only emerged from the bushes, seemed to be swimming in a sea of flowers. A few miles farther, the fairy-like gardens gradually grew thin and scattered, till a few rosy patches only remained, here and there, where dwarf bunches of azaleas struggled obstinately for life against the dizzy heights. The track now entered the fantastic region near the frontier passes. The coral and the sea polar, both above 15,000 feet. In the intense silence of these wild majestic solitudes, icy, crystalline, purling brooks chattered gently. From the shore of a melancholy lake, a golden-crowned bird solemnly watched my caravan as it passed. Up and up we went, skirting gigantic glaciers, catching occasional glimpses of crossing valleys filled by huge clouds. And then, without any transition, as we issued from the mists, the Tibetan tableland appeared before us, immense, void and resplendent under the luminous sky of Central Asia. Since then I have traveled across the country lying behind the distant mountain ranges which, at that moment, bound my horizon. I have seen Lhasa, Shigatse, the northern grassy solitudes with their salt lakes as large as seas, calm, the country of brigand knights and magicians, the unexplored forests of Po and the enchanting valleys of Zarong where the pomegranates ripen, but nothing has ever dimmed, in my mind, the memory of my first sight of Tibet. A few weeks later the weather changed, the snow began to fall again. My provisions were on the verge of giving out, porters and servants grew irritable and quarrelsome. One day I had to use my riding whip to separate two men who were fighting with knives for a place near the campfire. After a few short excursions into Tibetan territory I left the frontier. I was not equipped for a long journey and, moreover, the land that lay in front of me was forbidden ground. Again I crossed Lakhn, saw the Gomchen and talked with him about his hermitage that was a day's march distant, higher up in the mountains. He had lived there for 17 years. These plain details my boy could easily translate and I myself could follow a certain amount of his conversation. However, I did not risk mentioning the demons, said by popular opinion to be his servants. I knew my young interpreter was too superstitious to dare to approach this subject and, probably, also the lama would not have answered such inquiries. I returned to Gangtok, sad at having missed the opportunity of learning things of real interest regarding the mystery world of Tibetan anchorites, which I had skirted by chance. I did not, in the least, foresee the curious consequences of my trip. A little while after this, the Dalai Lama left Klimpong. His army had beaten the Chinese and he was to go back to Lhasa in triumph. I went to bid him farewell at a hamlet situated below the Jalap Pass. I arrived ahead of him at the bungalow where he was to stop. There I found many noblemen of the Sikkimese court in great distress. They were in charge of the preparations for the short stay of the lamaking, but, as is usual in the East, everything had come too late. Furniture, rugs, hangings were not in place and the distinguished guest might appear at any minute. Everything was in confusion in the small house, with masters and servants wildly rushing about. It amused me to lend a helping hand and arrange the cushions that would serve the Dalai Lama for a bed. Some of the assistants assured me that this would bring me good luck, now and in lives to come. Here I had another opportunity of talking with the Tibetan sovereign. His thoughts seemed entirely directed towards political affairs. As usual, he blessed the devotees with his duster made of ribbons, but one felt that his mind had already crossed the mountain pass that marks the frontier and was busy organizing the profits of his victory.